Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Tonight on All In, Republican hostage taking 101.
Biden would take the blame, and that's the one way to make sure Biden's not reelected.
Tonight, another round of negotiations as the clock ticks towards default. Then,
I think this obstruction case is a tight case, and yes, I do think he'll go to jail on it.
A classified document investigation expands into Trump's business dealings, as E. Jean Carroll says she plans to seek more damages from the ex-president.
I'd love to have Robbie Kaplan just shut him up.
And the latest chilling example of America in reverse as Nebraska's governor signs a combination anti-trans and anti-abortion law.
Women will die. Children are dying. It is your fault. It is your fault. And you are allowing it to happen.
But All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. Well, we appear to be just days away from the potential collapse of the global economy. Strange way to start the show, but that's where we're headed, at least as of now. Again, I don't think we're going to get there, but that's the sort of the way that we're going. And it's amidst that and the threat explicitly Republicans are threatening that President Biden held another round of negotiations with Republican Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy over a deal to raise the so-called debt ceiling. That is the amount of money that the U.S. is allowed to borrow. There is still no deal ahead of a deadline that could come as soon as June 1st, although McCarthy called today's meeting productive.
They're going to come back together, work through the night, and see if the president and I, look, we know the deadline. I think the president and I are going to talk every day to try to find until we get this done.
McCarthy also decried, quote, governing by a chaos, which is a bit rich, because he and his fellow Republicans are, of course, holding the economy hostage, threatening to default on the national debt unless Biden and Democrats agree to federal spending cuts. And to be clear, these cuts would make life materially worse for millions of Americans. Cutting the budget by a fifth, 22%, which Republicans have proposed, would result in, here's just some estimates, 80,000 students losing access to Pell Grants, 200,000 kids losing access to Head Start programs, 430,000 low-income families getting evicted, 640,000 American families losing access to rental assistance, 1 million poor Americans with young kids losing access to food assistance, 2 million individuals and families losing access to health care via community health centers, and many other terrible preventable outcomes. And while a lot of folks are talking about how bad these spending cuts would be, or how catastrophic, truly, defaulting on the debt would be for the first time in American history, tonight I want to talk about something a little different. Because not enough people are talking about why this is all happening in the first place. And I mean, like, really, let's just go down to fundamentals. We're watching the story. Maybe you've seen it. What is this about? Why are we having a debt ceiling showdown? Why are Republicans threatening to tank the global economy and default for the first time in this country's history unless they get their way to impose austerity and cut federal spending on those programs severely? Now, the stated justification for the hostage taking, you hear it everywhere, doesn't make any sense. And this is really the key to understanding this whole thing. The sort of top line answer, which again has been taken for granted as the answer in most mainstream coverage, is that Republicans want to cut spending. And they want to cut spending because they have an ideological commitment to cutting spending. You see that everywhere. Kevin McCarthy says it. The reporters, by and large, that report on him tend to sort of go along with that. That's the fight. It is simply not true. It is maddening to see it repeated because it cannot possibly be the actual answer. And this isn't speculation or mind reading on my part. These are just the facts, the history. This is an empirical situation. We know that cannot be the answer because we have seen what the Republican Party does when it has control of the government and is free to pursue its agenda. When Republicans control both houses of Congress and the presidency. You were alive for this. I was too. We were all here. We saw it all happen, right? What did they do? Well, they cut taxes for corporations and rich people. And they do that every time without fail, right? And that's because the Republican Party really does believe in that. They really do believe in cutting taxes for corporations and rich people. They really do use their power to make it happen. It's the one piece of legislation they'll manage to get passed even when they're screwing up left and right. Didn't George W. Bush, right? Didn't jump. They push deregulation. They make life harder for undocumented immigrants. They restricted illegal immigration. Sometimes they pick cultural fights. They tend to boost spending for defense. But one thing they do not do when they have unified control of the federal government is reduce spending. Again, this is just a historical fact. I'm not doing any mind reading. I'm just telling you the simple fact of the matter. When they have control of the government, they do the opposite of reducing spending. They increase spending when their party is in power, when they control the White House. Why? Well, I think because, in the main, government spending is popular and tends to boost the political fortunes of the White House and the president, in this case, a Republican president. It helps the Republican president get reelected. Axios put together this handy chart of government spending. The purple line is defense. The brown line is everything else. You can see it there. Spending goes up during the administration of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. And then it slows down a little bit. See that little flat line? During the Clinton years. Okay? Again, that's when Bill Clinton was a president. And then after the House got taken over by Newt Gingrich, right? Republicans had a big budget standoff and they imposed spending cuts, right? Then what happens? Well, then spending skyrockets under George W. Bush. Okay, see how that line goes up, right? Again, George W. Bush takes office. He's got a House and Senate, right? Republicans, they forced the country into two very pointless, very expensive wars. They also ran up a lot of domestic spending. And then what happens after that? Oh, look, it drops again pretty dramatically under the Democratic president. And see the dip around 2011 there? That's the last time that Republicans were in opposition and held the House and held the debt ceiling hostage. The exact same playbook as right now. They demanded Democrats agree to painful, unpopular spending cuts or else Republicans would crater the economy. So again, Republicans in power spent for decades while they had the presidency, turned around, pretended to care about curbing spending once Democrats are in power. Bill Clinton, certainly Barack Obama. And again, why? What's going on? Why are they not consistent, right? The answer is very simple and straightforward. They wanted to make it harder for Barack Obama to get reelected. Here's Mitch McConnell just days after Republicans retook Congress in 2010.
Over the past week, some have said it was indelicate of me to suggest that our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term. But the fact is, if our primary legislative goals are to repeal and replace the health spending bill, to end the bailouts, cut spending, and shrink the size and scope of government, the only way to do all of those things is to put someone in the White House who won't veto any of these things.
But they don't want to shrink the size and scope of government. They just had control of the government under George W. Bush, and they did not shrink its scope or its size. Again, you can't take what they're saying at face value because it makes no sense. So, Obama was forced to strike a deal to get the debt ceiling raised, which pushed austerity measures that appreciably slowed the recovery from the financial crisis. It made the economy worse. It created unnecessary misery for millions. It also made it worse than it should have been when he was running for a second term in 2012. You can see it right here on this chart. The top line is how much the government was projected to spend during the Obama years. The bottom line is how much the government actually spent after the Tea Party forced Democrats to cut spending. See how the bottom line, the amount the country has spent, is way lower than what originally was projected before Republicans demanded cuts? But then you'll see something else. See how it kind of bows up there, starts to go up? It looks like the bottom line starts to tick up around. Drum roll, please. When could it be? Ah, yes, 2017. Right after Donald Trump was elected and Republicans controlled Congress. What did they do? They started spending, of course. Let's go back to the first chart for a second and look at government spending under Trump. Oh, yeah, it skyrocketed. Look at the line shoot up. Non-military spending in particular went way up under Trump than Republicans. In fact, Republicans spent so much, partnered with massive tax cuts to the rich and corporations, the deficit increased nearly 40% under Trump. Now, again, I'm belaboring this a little bit, but I can't bear it, okay? I think at this point, everyone sort of agrees Republicans don't actually care about the federal deficit. That was the old excuse, and no one buys it anymore. Clearly, they don't. You can't care about the deficit while you're also pushing massive tax cuts for the rich. Untenable. But people still haven't really come around to the even more basic idea that Republicans, they don't care about spending either, the size and scope of government. But that's what the numbers say. Again, this is just, I'm just reading you the history. So then the question becomes, this is a little bit of a mystery. Well, not really a big one. But the question is, if Republicans don't care about spending, which they don't, then why are they forcing a crisis over the debt ceiling? What's it really all about? And again, the answer is very simple. It is about asserting dominance over the Democratic president and hurting his political fortunes. I know that sounds cynical, but there is literally no other way to interpret the remarkably consistent position Republicans take about these matters of spending. President Biden himself acknowledged as much over the weekend.
I think there are some MAGA Republicans in the House who know the damage that it would do to the economy. And because I am president and presidents are responsible for everything, Biden would take the blame, and that's the one way to make sure Biden's not reelected.
Look at it this way. Republicans recognize high degrees of spending under a president tend to be politically popular. In fact, Mitch McConnell admitted as much back in 2019. Everyone else has forgotten this quote, but I have not. This is tattooed in my brain, because back in 2019, the Washington Post reported, quote, Mitch McConnell told President Trump privately that no politician has ever lost an election for spending more money. Inverse is also true. Lowering the amount of government spending tends to hurt the economy, hurt American voters, tends to be politically unpopular. So again, the Republican calculus is simple. You spend like there's no tomorrow when you're in power because it helps you politically. When you're out of power, you do everything possible to stop Democrats from spending in order to hurt them. And it just so happens Republicans have some pretty great leverage in these negotiations by, again, threatening to blow up the world economy. The current MAGA Republican Party is completely untethered from any unifying vision of the social contract, particularly on matters of political economy, where they're all over the place. They don't really know even what they want. So they're totally fine taking the economy hostage to get their way. They have the leverage because so many of them are political nihilists who don't really believe in anything except their own power. And there's a reason why you have this cliche. You've heard it all the time, right? Negotiating with terrorists. And the reason people invoke that cliche is you're at an inherent disadvantage negotiating with someone who is going to do something malevolent and destructive, completely unbound by any rules or norms. But also, if you give in to that person and their demands, it then incentivizes them to act in the same way in the future. And this is why we're here. Barack Obama gave in largely to their demands in 2011. And here we are, more than a decade later, in the exact same position. Only now, I would argue, Republicans are even possibly more sociopathic about this stuff than they were during the Tea Party years. Like, do you really think the Republican conference that voted for Donald Trump's coup is going to think twice before blowing up the economy to hurt Joe Biden? I frankly don't have a solution here. President Biden says he won't sidestep the issue by invoking the constitutional requirement that the government pay its debts. It's written right there in the 14th Amendment. It says the debt shall not be questioned. That seems pretty definitive to me. And many of them have called to do that. And the Democrats get some blame here because they did not raise the debt ceiling during the lame duck session after last year's midterms, like many folks, including myself and Senator Bernie Sanders, said they should do. So here we are. But we're in this position chiefly because the Republican Party wants, more than anything else in the world, for Joe Biden to lose, and a Republican, most likely the guy who tried to end American democracy, to win in 2024. But the least we in the media can do is accurately describe what's actually happening. Joining me now is Jeff Stein, the Washington Post White House economics reporter. Jeff, I find it hard to follow all this, partly because it's opaque, partly because I think a lot of the stated rationale for a lot of it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if I'm following it properly, about 85% of the total federal budget has been taken off the table by Republicans, as have increases in revenue, increases in taxes, closing tax loopholes. So it's like there's a tiny sliver of the budget left, and that's going to have to get fairly severe cuts according to the math provided by the Republican House caucus, right?
Well, what the Republicans would say is that the numbers that they're proposing would still be below, even adjusting for inflation, what President Obama called for at the end of his administration. So by some standards, this is historically elevated. It's not, by European standards or by standards of even really most Western democracies, elevated levels of spending as a percent of GDP, but relative to where we were at the end of the Obama administration. Of course, if you're someone who relies on one of the dozens of programs you outlined at the beginning of the show, that might not be much comfort. But yes, that is the correct analysis. It's about 15% of the budget, and their math is made more complicated by the fact that they're seeking defense increases, more military spending, more border spending, at the same time that the overall pool of money that they're insisting on has to go down. So that increase in military spending that they're insisting on makes that math just that much harder.
Well, you've been reporting a lot about the sort of constitutional option here, right? The 14th Amendment says the U.S. debt should not be questioned. A lot of people are saying this entire hostage negotiation situation, in which the government has already voted to appropriate the money, the spending is what it is, the taxes are what they are, Congress and the president signed off on all of this. So it produced the debt that has to be paid, that it's a constitutional requirement to pay your debts. There's a letter circulating by Senate Democrats. What is the status of that? And what would that even mean in reality to invoke it?
It's a great question. My understanding of what the legal scholars are calling for here is essentially for Biden to come out with an executive order or some kind of statement saying that our legal counsel has reviewed this and found that, in fact, this is incompatible with the debt ceiling law, which makes really no sense, frankly, and this only exists in one other country across the world to have an incompatible set of spending laws with a borrowing limit, that would then be kicked. The administration would say, we're going to go forward and only, follow the spending and tax laws and not the debt limit. However, and I've been reporting this for months, the Biden administration and particularly Treasury Secretary Yellen is very concerned that this could lead to a financial crisis on its own, because the way the U.S. government funds itself is by Treasury auctions, by auctioning off debt, essentially IOUs. And if that process is challenged by the courts or by Republicans, you could end up in a real dangerous situation where interest rates still spike and you still have a financial crisis, according to the administration.
Yeah. The key point here, right, is that if you don't raise the debt ceiling, you have two completely inconsistent orders from the law, which is to pay the debts and not to pay the debts, which the executive is going to have to do something with. Jeff Stein has been great on reporting on this. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. There's all kinds of trouble for Donald Trump tonight. There's an expanded investigation into his overseas business, a new defamation charge from E. Jean Carroll resulting from, well, I'll let you guess. I'll tell you on the flip side. Also, his own lawyers think that he is headed to the clink. George Conway joins me on all that next.
The International Rescue Committee works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Lebanon, displaced families are experiencing rough winter weather on top of war, hunger, and displacement. All of this has driven up food prices, destroyed infrastructure, and driven millions from their homes. Donations help the IRC provide families with resources like food, shelter, fuel, medicine, blankets, and cash assistance. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.
The New York Times is out with a bombshell report tonight concerning Special Counsel Jack Smith's criminal investigation into Trump's handling of classified documents. The Times reports that federal prosecutors have issued a subpoena, quote, for information about Mr. Trump's business dealings in foreign countries since he took office. According to the Times, a subpoena, quote, suggests that Mr. Smith is exploring whether there is any connection between Mr. Trump's deal-making abroad and the classified documents he took with him when he left office. That is not the only bad headline for the ex-president today in the documents case. We now have new reporting for The Guardian that one of Trump's current attorneys has receipts as to potential obstruction. The Guardian is reporting, NBC News has not yet confirmed, that Trump's attorney, Evan Corcoran, preserved nearly 50 pages of contemporaneous notes detailing that Trump was warned about retaining classified documents after he was subpoenaed by DOJ in May. And, as if things could not get any worse for Trump legally, he's now facing new trouble for comments he made about writer E. Jean Carroll on national television just one day after being found liable for sexual abuse and defamation and ordered to pay $5 million in damages. Tonight, Ms. Carroll is seeking in Manhattan federal court a, quote, very substantial additional amount of damages in response to Donald Trump's comments on CNN. The filing says tonight that she should be awarded these damages to, quote, punish Trump, to deter him from engaging in further defamation and to deter others from doing the same. George Conway is a conservative attorney and former Republican. He joins me now. George, let me start on the E. Jean Carroll news. I know you had talked to her at some point about the case. You were invoked in closing arguments as a sort of boogeyman that was behind the whole thing. It seemed eminently predictable that CNN was going to be hosting defamation when they had him on the day after this. He then proceeded to say things about her that are very similar to what he said that got him found guilty of defamation. Do you think this is a strong case, and what's it mean?
Well, I think she has a strong case for adding those punitive damages claims to her prior complaint. The complaint that she's amending this time was actually the original complaint from the first lawsuit that Jean brought in 2019 when President Trump, as president, from the bully pulpit of the right. Oval Office, denied that anything ever happened at Bergdorf Goodman and basically accused Jean of being a liar. And she got $3 million for the second libel occurred in 2022 when he was dumb enough to repeat right. the first libel. And in this time, he wasn't president, so he didn't have this legal argument, because that's why right. the first case went off on a wild goose chase in the appellate courts. But now it's come back. He's now, that case already had more damages potentially than the case that she already won, than the $3 million she already won, because he was president at the time. It was the very, very first libel that he made on Jean Carroll. And now the fact that he has repeated the libel after being found to have sexually abused her and libeled her is really, really, it's outrageous, and it's supportive of punitive damages. This verdict could be greater than the $5 million that she got in the first case. I hope it is, because I think at some point he's got to stop lying about this and stop libeling her. I mean, you know, how many times are we going to have to go through this?
Well, this is interesting. Trump's attorney's response is Ms. Carroll's 11th hour attempt to amend her complaint exposes the true motivation behind her numerous lawsuits. And it's like, yes, the true motivation is to get him to stop defaming her. I think yes. it's pretty clear.
Yeah,
I'm
it's
like, yes,
simple.
Yes. Let's talk about the Jack Smith reporting in the New York Times. I have to say, I was like, wait, what? They're looking business records in 2017? What do you make of that?
I don't think he needed a financial incentive to do what he did. I think his insane narcissism and his belief that he controls everything, that Article 2 allowed him to do whatever he wants, and that there were his generals across the river at the Pentagon, these were his documents.
Right.
I mean, his narcissism alone was sufficient for him to want to keep these documents and then, of course, to show them off to people. And, you know, the only thing that could really make this worse is if, you know, you had a FedEx slip showing that he sent them to the Saudis or the Kremlin or whatnot.
Right.
And maybe he did that. Almost anything is possible with this guy. But the thing that's interesting about this is it's not necessary to put this man in jail. It doesn't matter whether he gave these documents to a foreign power. And it almost doesn't really matter necessarily, although it makes it much, much worse because it would be an independent violation of the Espionage Act. It doesn't matter whether he showed off Kim Jong-un's letter or whatever he thought he was showing off to visitors at his office if he was doing that, because of the obstruction charges are so strong. I mean, Ty Cobb, the White House counsel who handled, in the Trump administration, handled the Mueller investigation, went basically on a national television the other day and said, Trump's going to go to jail for this. And he should and he will, because the obstruction case is just so strong, as illustrated by the fact that all these lawyers' notes these lawyers had to testify. Because, you look, it's bad enough that he told, you know, that he made his lawyers give false information to the government. And he used his lawyers as instruments to commit a crime or a fraud. And it's one thing, you know, it's sufficient to show probable cause to get a search warrant, that which they got in August. But to get lawyers' notes and lawyers' testimony, judges don't like to order that, because judges are lawyers. They were practicing lawyers. They respect the attorney-client privilege. And to pierce that privilege is something they don't like to do. And the fact that that Judge Howell here in the District of Columbia was willing to do it shows that the evidence is incredibly strong.
Yeah, I think that's all that is correct. George Conway, thank you so much for your time. Still ahead, why the current frontrunner for the nomination is actually welcoming his newest primary opponent, very graciously, the ever-growing Republican field. Next.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Today, Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, announced his candidacy for the president in a speech that used his own personal history as the son of a single mother who rose to become the first black Republican elected to the Senate from the South since Reconstruction as proof of America's greatness. Tim Scott is, of course, deeply conservative, a staunch opponent of abortion rights. Judging by today, he seems to be running on a message of hope and aspiration. And he is, as of now, the only black candidate among a growing field of Republican contenders, one that is, of course, dominated by the looming presence of the former president. And when NBC's Tom Lamas asked Scott today why voters should choose him over that guy, Donald Trump, the best he could muster was a kind of vague suggestion that he can appeal to more voters for the power of persuasion.
What will you offer voters that former President Trump will not?
Well, the question is, I'm running for president, period. I plan to win. So the question is, what do the voters want in their president? They want someone who can persuade on the issues that matter the most to them.
Adam Serwer is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he joins me now. You know, I always feel a little bit empathy for someone who's running in a crowded primary field of, like, why you? Because it's actually sort of a hard question to answer in many ways. But I'm not sure the Tim Scott why you question is, I think it needs some workshopping if it's going to work in this field. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Tim Scott is caught in the same paradox as all the other Republican candidates, which is that how do you beat Donald Trump when Donald Trump is an almost religious cult-like figure in the Republican Party at this moment? And to criticize him is to open yourself up to being called disloyal or not a real Republican and not a real conservative.
You know, Trump also, I mean, I watched the event today. I'm not sure if you did, but one of the things that's striking to me is that people say this weird thing of, like, if you like Trump's policies, but his personality turned you off, as if, like, that's a real Republican constituency. And I think it's actually quite the opposite. They like Trump, the figure, the character. That's the thing it's all about. So this idea that, like, what about a quieter, less charismatic person who pursued it just seems, I mean, again, I'm not the target audience, but it just seems like the reverse of what actually is going on here. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these traditionally Republican policies, these conservative policies, particularly economic policies, are not all that popular. And Donald Trump got past all that in part by moderating on some of those policies, promising not to cut certain parts of the social safety net. But also because people liked his FU personality. I'm sorry to say that on a family television show, but I think that that really is a big part of it. And so if you have like a milquetoast Republican who is offering the unpopular policies and also does not have that juice, you know, I think it's difficult for them to win over people who are already gung-ho for Trump.
Yeah, the do you have the juice question, I think, is the question that kind of hangs over a lot of the field. I wanted to play this clip of Ron DeSantis, who's working the crowds in New Hampshire. And, you know, there's people who said he's not a particularly adept retail politician, that he's been in a little bit of a bubble in Florida, and others who just say, look, running for president's unlike anything else. But here's him in doing the sort of New Hampshire diner set piece. Take a look. Take a look.
So we'll do it. Okay.
Hey, Ron.
How you doing? Good. What's your name?
I'm Tim Anson.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. Great to be up in New Hampshire.
I love what's your name. I love okay as a response to what's your name. Again, all this stuff is like, it is what it is. I'm not sure in the end how much it matters, but it does seem to me that like the charisma question looms large just particularly because of how the Trump phenomenon developed in that party.
Look, I'm going to be honest with you. You know, I'm not like a huge social butterfly. So, you know, I empathize with DeSantis, but he looks like someone who doesn't want to be there. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't want to be talking to those people. So, you know, and that's like obvious in his face. And I get it. I wouldn't want to be doing that either. But when you run for president, you kind of have to be like good at that stuff. And maybe he'll get better. I mean, maybe he'll get better at it. It's like a skill, you can develop it. But certainly right now, he seems visibly uncomfortable in those kind of settings, which again, are unnatural. I get it. I understand it. I wouldn't want to be in that situation. But if you want to run for president, you really got to get good at that stuff.
There was some palpable white knuckling effort just wafting off him in that room. Adam Serwer, always good to talk to you. Thank you. Coming up, as Republicans ban abortion care and gender-affirming care in Nebraska in one bill, I'll talk to a state senator who is doing everything she can to fight back. Next. So, Fox News is trying to stop the bleeding in the wake of its $787 million agreement with Dominion Voting Systems, one of the largest defamation settlements of all time. Their latest cost-cutting move is, apparently, axing the network's entire investigative unit. That's according to a report from Rolling Stone. Sort of funny that Fox would fire its investigative journalists, of all people, after settling a lawsuit about how they spread misinformation and lies. I personally don't think that group was really the source of their problems. While the network makes changes behind the scenes, it appears to be business as usual on air and in print in the Murdoch empire. Let's take this front page story in the Murdoch-owned New York Post earlier this month. You can see it right there. Vets kicked out for migrants. Outrage as upstate hotels tell 20 homeless veterans to leave. The Post cited a nonprofit group, the Yerik Israel Tony Foundation, that said the veterans, quote, including a 24-year-old man in desperate need of help after serving in Afghanistan, were told by the hotels that their temporary housing was getting pulled out from under them. According to the Post, the hotels are not believed to have migrants yet, but were reportedly on the city's shortlist to take some. Now, the CEO of that nonprofit did admit that the hotels didn't explicitly say the vets had to move because of the migrants, but it was clear to her that was the case given the timing. But this was far more than enough for Fox News. They really ran with this story, featuring it on no less than 15 different shows over the past 10 days. The network even claimed to have, crucially, substantiated the reporting themselves.
A group of veterans, some suffering from PTSD, may now be victims of New York's migrant busing battle. Fox News confirms 20 homeless vets just got kicked out of several hotels in the suburbs north of Manhattan to make room for those migrants getting bused in from the city.
Remember that phrase, Fox News confirms. Fox News confirms. Republican lawmakers piled on, with one, New York State Assemblyman Brian Maher, introducing a bill in response to the story that would ban displacing homeless veterans from shelters. Presidential contender Nikki Haley retweeted the New York Post article, commenting, quote, liberal insanity at work. And Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, not to be left behind, blamed Joe Biden's immigration policies, calling the entire situation shameful. To Todd Young of Indiana even brought up the story on the Senate floor.
In New York City, where illegal migrants have displaced homeless veterans in hotels, Mayor Eric Adams said, quote, the president and the White House have failed this city.
Okay. Do you know where I'm going with this? What do you think? Well, the whole thing unraveled. A local paper, God bless them, the Mid-Hudson News, reported the story was a lie, according to the hotel that was accused of forcing the veterans out. The paper and the hotel debunked a purported receipt for the veterans' rooms provided by Assemblyman Marr as a poorly edited fake. The hotel manager said there were no veterans at the hotel, none were kicked out, and no other guests were told to vacate. So you might think, okay, maybe they just invented the whole thing, but no, it gets better. Because the following day, the paper reported that several homeless men, not veterans, had come forward to say they had been recruited for this scam. They were told they were going to meet with an elected official for a discussion on homelessness and were each promised $200 along with food and alcohol. After eating and drinking at a diner, the CEO of the nonprofit told them they were going to a meeting where she would be explaining how they had been kicked out of a hotel to make room for migrants and coached them to, and I quote here, to act like we were the veterans that had been displaced. The CEO admitted to the Mid-Hudson News that she provided the men from the shelter to appear as if they were displaced vets, but denies offering to pay them. According to three of the men who spoke to the Times Union, they never received that money they were promised. Quote, everything was a scam. She didn't have the intention of paying us anything. Assemblyman Marr says he was duped by the nonprofit as well. And now, well, Fox News, having gone pretty all in on this story, has been forced to issue a rare correction. That job falling to unlucky host Laura Ingraham on Friday night.
Before we go, a little update on a story we brought you this week about homeless vets being displaced from hotels so that illegals could move in. Turns out the group behind the claim made it up. We have no clue as to why anyone would do such a thing, but we'll bring you any updates should they come.
Oh, at the end of the show on a Friday night, you just got in there. Yeah, Laura, why would anyone want to make up a story that's too good to check but plays directly into the most deranged bias of your conservative audience? I can't imagine Fox News airing those kinds of lies, but I guess there's a first time for everything.
You do literally have blood on your hands, and if you vote for this, you will have buckets and buckets of blood on your hands. You've got maybe a handful of weeks to get the medical care that you need if you are pregnant right now. Nothing I say matters in this chamber, so I'm just gonna say the unvarnished truth. That this place is morally bankrupt, that you are playing political games with the lives of children and parents in this state to get something. It's gross. It's vile.
That was Nebraska Democratic State Senator Michaela Kavanaugh fighting against a bill that would deny transgender minors gender-affirming care and ban abortion at 12 weeks. Ultimately, the majority Republican legislature passed the bill, and today Republican Governor Jim Pillen signed it. Nebraska is now one of 20 states with abortion bans on the books, as well as the 20th state to ban gender-affirming care for trans youth. And Nebraska Democratic State Senator Michaela Kavanaugh, who represents the people of Central and West Central Omaha, joins me now. Senator, thank you for making time for us tonight. I guess I'd first start with just, given how hard you fought against this, you had a standing filibuster for a long time to try to sort of slow down the wheels of progress on this legislation. The meaning of this being signed into law, what it means for the people that you represent?
Well, I would say, first of all, today starts week 13. I'm not done filibustering. So there's more bad things that they can do, and I'm not going to stop just because they accomplished one terrible goal, or I guess they got a twofer on this one. But what the passage of this bill means is that women and birthing people in Nebraska are going to be denied access to essential health care starting today. The governor signed it into law today, and it had an emergency clause that impacts reproductive health care. And so from this moment forward, no one who has a gestational pregnancy after 9 to 10 weeks can get the health care that they need. So that's a huge devastation for the people of Nebraska, and then the added devastation of the underlying bill, which is to prohibit gender-affirming care for transgender youth. And I think that the signing of this bill today just marks the beginning of a much, much bigger, broader fight that we are going to have in this state and across this country to ensure that health care for transgendered individuals is protected.
Let me ask you this. You're up close and personal with this. And I think if you covered local politics as a reporter and particularly looked at sort of what the right was sort of really fixated on, it wouldn't be that surprising that these two issues, abortion bans and bans for care, trans care, not just for minors in some states, would be top of the line. What is your understanding of this obsession, this focus, this prioritization of these two issues among your Republican colleagues in your state? Why?
I think they have the numbers right now, and so they have to capitalize on that. And the only way to get this done is to do it immediately, to do it messy, and to rush it through, because they can't jeopardize that they'll have the same number of votes when we have our next legislative session. After the 2024 elections, this entire body could look very different. And they got this by one vote. And the original bill, the LB 626, that was a total ban on abortion, failed by one vote. So they got this bill by one vote. So this is not wide sweeping in Nebraska. This is very, very tight margins. And they are trying to get their wins in for their base. And that's what it's about, is getting the wins for the base. It's not about healthcare for Nebraskans. It's politics.
What do you think the political ramifications, obviously the substantive ramifications are dire, but the political ramifications will be? I mean, that idea of rushing, right, this idea of sort of get it through while you have the vote, suggests they don't feel particularly confident about the degree to which this reflects public opinion in the state. Do you think there will be political backlash for this bill that they just passed and signed?
Absolutely. We saw an outpouring of the business community, the religious community, the medical community, the parental community, every community that you could possibly think about came out in force in opposition to these bans, and they still did it. So there's absolutely going to be political ramifications for them. And we're seeing that with my colleagues and I. We started a group called don'tlegislatehate.org because we knew that this was coming and because we knew that we had to get prepared, get organized for the future of the political outbreak on all of this. It's going to be a mess. And I hope that the phoenix that rises out of this mess is that we come to have transgendered individuals in our state and in our country living in the light that they deserve to live in.
In terms of prioritization, so there's political backlash both sort of on the issue, right? People that want trans folks to live in the light, as you say, who want women to have control of their bodily autonomy. But there's also prioritization. Just doesn't seem to me like this is the biggest issue, like trans youth healthcare in Nebraska. And I'm just curious about how that prioritization lands or how they justify it.
Yeah, they haven't justified it. We haven't passed any of our tax packages here in Nebraska, and we are on day 82 of a 90-day session, and we haven't passed a single tax cut when we have massive wealth at this moment in time in the state. And we're going to pass tax cuts, I think, in the next 8 days, but I don't know. And they prioritize this over what is generally our job: taxes, budget.
So just to be clear, they've been so insistent on this, they have pushed off all the budget stuff for 82 days of the 90-day session so that they can get this dual ban of abortions and trans health care for minors.
We passed the budget on day 80, which is the last day possible in our state constitution to pass the budget. So they pushed it till the end and they still rushed this through. And yes, they're prioritizing this above everything else. And I don't think that that's what Nebraska really wants.
Nebraska,
I don't think that's what anybody wants.
I don't disagree. Nebraska State Senator Michaela Kavanaugh, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Appreciate it. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.